What does it mean to be a man? What is masculinity? What is this quest for masculinity? Today, we'll talk with the author of Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity, a new book from Concordia Publishing House. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. Find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Concordia University, you'll find them in the sponsor section. Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be masculine? To help us answer that question, author of the new book from Concordia Publishing House, Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity, the Reverend Jeff Hammer. Pastor Hammer, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thanks, Andy. Good to be with you.
I should say welcome back to Faith and Family. Glad to have some time to talk with you this morning and celebrating the release of your new book available on Concordia Publishing House. And I think in hands today or tomorrow, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, tomorrow is what they tell me.
All right. So heading off the shelves of the warehouse and out to the hands of folks, talking about masculinity. What did you think when you first started working on this project? How did this project even come to you? Was this a request, or was this something you had started working on? Why did you write about this quest for masculinity?
Yeah, that's a fun story. So I became interested, I don't know, I'm a man, right? And I became interested, I was made aware of a book called The Art of Manliness.
Uh-huh.
Probably about 8 or 9 years ago now it came out. And it was a secular book, so I was kind of taken in with this idea that even in the secular realm, the distinction between men and women is still honored and revered. There's still something, even from a purely secular perspective, that sees masculinity as good, as a force to be protected, and as something that needs to be cultivated within boys growing to be men, within young men struggling to be men, within older men still, you know, living in the world as men. And so I kind of took off from there, and when the author of this book started doing a podcast, I was listening to his podcast, and then you kind of see a similar groundswell of interest in masculinity throughout the rest of sort of secular culture, and it's kind of a reaction against the egalitarianism of our culture that says, you know, everybody is the same. We ought to treat everyone in exactly the same way, educate boys and girls in the same way, treat men and women in the same way. Men should treat women the same way they treat men. Women should treat men the same way they treat women. So as a reaction against all of this, there is kind of a, I don't know if you call it countercultural movement or a men's movement. And really it's older than a lot of, you know, the new books that are coming out. It probably goes back. A lot of people identify a book called Iron John as sort of the beginning of the modern men's movement. And then that, you know, that swept through the church a little bit around 2000 or so. John Eldridge had a book, Wild at Heart, which was all about, you know, God is wild and makes men wild, and they, you know, find their calling and their purpose in life in this sort of wildness, which really was the Christian version of Robert Bly's Iron John. So I got interested in all of this, and mostly for my own personal development. Never really thought, you know, anything would come of it. But, you know, wrote about it a little bit for myself, journaled on it, thought about it, listened to podcasts, read books. And then for a Higher Things presentation 1 year, I thought, well, this would be kind of interesting. let's offer to do a presentation on the differences between men and women, or between boys and girls, right? Growing up to be, I think the first year they said, oh, there's too many presentations on, you know, men and women in the church, so find something else to do. And then I came back and pitched the idea again a year or two later, and they liked it, so I did a presentation on it. And when we got home, my wife said, gosh, that was a good presentation, but you put a lot of work into that, not to get any, you know, compensation out of it. Why don't you see if, like, Lutheran Witness needs an article, or CPH needs a book, or something like that. It was good enough for that. So, you know, with that kick in the pants, I did that. I pitched it to a couple editors at CPH, and they said, you know, we're already working on a project like this, but thanks for the offer. And then a couple months later, I get an email from an editor who said, you know about that. We're now looking for an author, so please send us a writing sample. So that's what I did. And they said, great, we'd like to work with you. Please write a book. Sign this contract, and end a story, or beginning of story. I don't know. It's not really a book that's like a how-to guide. It's not a, you know, you guys should try to emulate me. I've really got this masculinity thing down, and you should do what I do. Because it's not at all like that. It really is just more a travelogue of my own struggles and the struggles that I've seen or heard from other men as I've been going down this road. So it certainly is not a book that says, Jeff Hemmer is an icon of masculinity, and you should do what he does.
What was it in those other podcasts and things that you were reading that drew you to them? Why is it important to address the topic of masculinity today?
Well, I think the culture is kind of learning something that the church has largely forgotten or kind of become embarrassed about, that there is this clear complementary difference between men and women that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And you know, I think maybe a lot of times as Lutherans, we get embarrassed that our church only allows men to serve in the pastoral office. That we have even in our polity, right, a clear demarcation between roles given to men and roles given to women. So maybe that embarrasses us. Maybe it, you know, is not the nicest conversation to have around the Thanksgiving table. So we just kind of we sweep that under the rug and we say, well, that's just about the pastoral office and everything else, you know, men and women are all the same and can do. So we get swept up in this cultural milieu, even while drawing, like, I don't know, a little bit of a line in the sand saying, okay, women can't be pastors, but everywhere else, we're all the same. And to hear the rest of culture saying, you know, what the Bible clearly teaches, that there's a difference between men and women. They have different roles, and they have different strengths, different functions in society, different ways that they relate to people. To hear all that, I guess, was kind of freeing, right? It allowed me to think about and confess more clearly the truths that are obviously there in Scripture about the differences between men and women. And to hear those from an outside perspective was encouraging in kind of a roundabout way.
What is the significance or uniqueness of masculinity in today's common worldview? Is there a uniqueness or a significance to masculinity in today's worldview, in the popular or more common worldview?
There is. And actually, you can see, well, across cultures, there's a fascinating study done by a Yale anthropologist, David Gilmore. I think it's called Manhood in the Making. And Gilmore studies cultures across the world and finds, almost without exception, men are expected to do three things, that there's sort of ways that men are judged as men on how well they do three things.
One of them is take out the trash, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. Well, sort of. these are the broad strokes, and then all the details fit in differently. So Gilmore says men across cultures are to provide for their families and their tribes, and right, so provide to protect their families, their tribes, their towns, their nations, everything, and to procreate. Now that we understand biology a little better, we understand that, you know, it takes two to tango. Men aren't the only ones responsible for procreation. And yet, we still speak of, like, virility as, you know, the ability of a man to produce offspring. So those are kind of universally regarded as hallmarks of masculinity and the tasks that men are given to do wherever they are, in whatever kinds of contexts they find themselves. And these are not unique to secular culture. In fact, they go all the way back to the garden, right? These are the things that Adam is given to do from the very beginning. He is he's called to, as head of his family, to protect his family, to provide for his family, and he and his wife together, she's not called Eve until after the fall into sin, in the most ironic naming of anyone in the Bible, she's called the mother of all the living when all of her offspring are dying, are given to procreate, to fill the earth with their offspring, to subdue and to have dominion over creation. So it really should be no surprise that these hallmarks of masculinity are still looked for in men across cultures, across the world, across time even. There really is, the virtue of masculinity or the exercise of manly virtues is not unique to the church, is not unique to any culture, but you find it in the Greeks. You find it in almost every culture throughout the world. The calling of a man to use his strength, his talents, his prowess, his wisdom, not for himself, but for the good of others, is almost universal, right? And see, those are that's what ties those three things that Gilmore talks about together: protect, provide, procreate. None of them is a selfish activity. They're all giving activities. And so this, if you distill it down to its most basic essence, masculinity is giving. And it's living one's life for the good of others.
Since you mentioned Adam, let's look at him. How is Adam an example of masculinity?
Well, he's first the example of perfect masculinity for just a brief, fleeting second. And then he's the example of anti-masculinity, the opposite of masculinity. So in the garden, he's given to do all these things. He's made head of his wife. He names creation. He gives order to everything. He's called to procreate. He is the first, right? He's the first to fill the threefold office, prophet, priest, and king. He's the one who preaches to his wife. When the serpent comes to Eve and says, "Did God really say?" Right, and she responds by saying, "We may eat of any tree in the garden, but of the tree in the middle of the garden we must not eat or even touch it." I used to kind of blame her, thinking that she was adding something to the word, but I think that's probably how Adam preached to her, right? And we confess that the preached word is no less the word of God than the written word or the incarnate word. So when Adam says, "Don't even touch it," that's a good, healthy, godly prohibition. He protects her, he serves her, he's called to give himself for her in a perfect kind of way, that the more he gives, he's never fully spent. His humanity is never diminished by how he gives. He doesn't sweat and bleed to provide for her. That's all the result of the fall. But then, in the fall, right in Genesis 3, which we just heard yesterday morning in church, Adam is exactly the opposite of what it means to be a man. And, Paul, right? Paul even says in 1 Corinthians that it is in fact a sin. Effeminacy is a sin, which is not, we hear effeminacy and we immediately think of homosexuality, but it's not at all that. The way the Greeks use this word, effeminacy, malakia, which actually for some reason does not even appear in the ESV translation. Most English translations just lump it together with adultery or men who practice homosexuality, which are the words on either side of it. Effeminacy is a word, right? Aristotle uses this word, and some of the other peripatetic philosophers use the word malakia to describe a man, sometimes a soldier, right? So he's a big, strong guy with a responsibility who shirks his duty to protect others in order to protect himself. He prefers the easy way, and so this is why it sometimes gets translated as a softness. It's a softness of selfishness. So this is exactly what you see in the garden then. This is exactly what Adam does, right? First of all, it's not like he's been at the factory all day making widgets or been out naming more animals as God brings them before him or cultivating the garden or anything. When the serpent comes to Eve and deceives her, she gives some to her husband who was with her. So Adam does all three of these things. He's self-centered. He's self-protecting. And he's self-focused. So he uses his wife as this kind of guinea pig experiment where, you know, he'll let her eat, see whether she falls over dead. When she doesn't, well, he'll take some and he'll eat too. And then when God comes, Adam's reaction, right, is to blame Eve, to throw her under the bus. And then, if that's not enough, God too, the woman whom you gave to me, she gave to me and I ate. What could I do, right? So Adam's masculinity in the fall is turned completely upside down. Everything is completely disordered. He becomes self-centered, focused on himself. Their eyes, right, when they sin, their eyes turn immediately to themselves, and he sees that he is naked for the first time, and he is ashamed. And shame involves this kind of self-awareness that Adam and Eve are not intended to have. They're not intended to be aware of themselves. They're intended to be aware of one another. Well, in sin, they become self-aware. And so Luther says all sin is really being turned in on ourselves. So Adam then becomes the anti-man, the antithesis of masculinity, and everything is disordered until the eternal second person of the triune God takes on human flesh and becomes a man. And so he then restores what Adam has lost. He becomes perfectly giving of himself, protecting of others, focused on others. His entire life, his entire mission, everything is focused on the good of his church. Right, on the good of his bride, without even at once a thought for himself. Never is self-preservation given priority number one. Always seeing himself as the means for the good of his wife. So what Adam loses, Christ restores in spades.
So how then has our understanding of masculinity changed over time? And how have we gotten to where we are today? Obviously, it started to change with the fall.
Yeah.
How has it gotten to where we are today with our skewed views? And we'll talk about those skewed views in just a little bit as well. But how did we get to this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the book, I ask it like this: which came first, the chicken or the feminist? So, right? I mean, man is, in his fallen state, I am inclined to be a chicken, inclined to abdicate the higher, holier calling of masculinity, to give of myself, to spend myself, to use myself as an instrument for the good of others, and instead to just look out for me, to protect my own interests, to preserve my flesh, to indulge in whatever, like, hedonistic pleasures there are. If it feels good, do it. And all of that is antithetical to masculinity. So that's all really easy, and that's the way my flesh is inclined since the fall. So men have been abdicating their masculine calling since Adam in the garden. Now, recently, our society has become enamored with the idea of, I don't know, not necessarily male bashing, but you can look back over, you know, the various waves of feminism, and what starts merely as a movement for equal rights for women, right? Allow women to vote and own property, and you can argue about individual property rights and those kinds of things all day, but what feminism has become, and then you have a second wave and a third wave of feminism, and it's evolved into not just men are worthless, but in fact men are evil, and masculinity is an undesirable trait to be militated against, to be fought against in men. So, right, you heard the it's often attributed to Gloria Steinem, though she didn't say it first. And her people wouldn't let me use it in the book with her name. Irina Dunn first said, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, right? Ha-ha, yuck-yuck, women don't need men, unless they want children, of course.
But that's a misunderstanding of what true masculinity is, what a man truly is. If it's a misunderstanding of masculinity, then how valuable is such a statement, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. No, I find no value in that statement.
Right.
I didn't intend to use it, like,
sure,
positively in the book.
Right.
Which is probably why they said, writing a book on masculinity, please don't mention Ms. Steinem at all. Okay. But that has changed, right? That's not the motto of feminism anymore. Now, and I talk about this in the book, too, there was, men are evil. Men are bad. So that now the phrase is like, there were T-shirts that were popular, 5 or 10 years ago, to the effect of boys are stupid. Throw rocks at them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine if a boy wore to school a shirt that says, like, you know, girls are dumb. Push them down the stairs. That dog don't hunt. I mean, that kid is turning his shirt inside out, probably, you know, facing in-school suspension or something like that. But, you know, a little bit of banter at the boys, like, that's expected, right? Because it's true. Even in our classrooms, we want boys to behave like girls. Sit still, be calm, talk about your feelings. Really just, like, sit still. And if we can't sit still, then we have all kinds of prescription medications that, you know, sort of take the edge off your boyishness. So
just the fact that we have the word feminist, and I rarely hear the word masculinist used at least in a positive way.
Yeah, right.
I think that demonstrates something. We need to take a quick break, Pastor Hemmer. When we come back, we'll talk more about the quest for masculinity. Pastor Hemmer's new book from Concordia Publishing House, Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
The media often portray pro-lifers as violent radicals, but it's not we who exhibit hostility. As if the inauguration and Berkeley violence wasn't enough, here's even more evidence. Texas State Representative Tony Tinderholt and his family have been under security protection because of multiple death threats. His great offense was introducing legislation ending abortion. Elizabeth Poe of Franklin, Tennessee, owns a knitting shop and posted her alarm on the shop's Facebook page regarding the vulgarity she witnessed at the Women's March in D.C., specifically about inappropriate props knitted with yarn. She had to call the police due to menacing Facebook posts and phone calls, some threatening rape and other violence. Please keep these brave warriors in your prayers. Neither is backing down.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, on behalf of Concordia Plan Services, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, the LCMS Foundation, Lutheran Housing Support Corporation, Concordia University System, and Corporate Synod, daily reaches out to our members and partners, working together to support our local, global, and international ministries, church workers, and LCMS initiatives at large to carry the mission forward and to serve each other in love. Opportunities to serve, lcms.org/jobsboard.
Human trafficking is modern-day slavery, and it happens in our own communities. Victims can be any gender, age, or race. Join the Department of Homeland Security's Blue Campaign to learn how to recognize and report this heinous crime. Visit our website at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. That's www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. Your second look could be their second chance.
I'm KFUO's Kip Allen. I'm a committed Lutheran, but I'm just a layman with no special theological training. Like many of us, I have questions and I seek guidance. I need answers given to me in a language I can understand. That's what this program's all about. Let's talk. The pastor is in.
Friday afternoon at 2 on KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We're talking with the Reverend Jeff Hemmer, author of Man Up, Biblical, the Quest for Masculinity, and taking a look at what does the Bible say about masculinity? Who is Adam? Who is Jesus? And were they examples of masculinity? Before we went to break, Jeff, we were talking about Adam as an example of masculinity and how we've gotten from Adam to where we are today, how Adam was an example and the example of the opposite example of masculinity as well, and where we've gotten today. What are some things that are often construed as masculine, but in reality, they're not really true examples of true masculinity?
Yeah. So, kind of in this context of a feminized society where, you know, masculinity is degraded as harmful to society, as something that we want to, you know, weed out of our boys and, you know, discipline them into being, you know, nice and respectable, which, you know, I would posit that, you know, niceness is not real masculinity. Goodness, kindness, that's all masculinity. But so in that, right, we have a culture where, you know, sort of mom rules, and it's the mothers who are bringing their children to church, and so you get churches that reflect this kind of feminized ethos where the essence of the church is to cultivate a personal relationship between the believer and Jesus, and that in and of itself, right, men don't really relate to that. But then you get, you know, music that with lyrics that could be like a, you know, the bad poetry of a horny teenage boy, you know, written to the girl he's trying to ask to prom, which is not, I mean, that's not the language of Scripture. There's a Roman Catholic theologian who attributes the first one to popularize the notion of the individual soul as the lover of Christ and the beloved of Christ, is Bernard of Clairvaux, whom we have, you know, we have a couple of his hymns, and he does a lot of good theologically, but Leon Poddles, in the feminization of, or the church impotent, the feminization of Christianity, hangs a lot on Bernard, blames a lot on him for this kind of the personal soul loved by Christ, which is not true, right? The church is the bride of Christ, and he has a personal, intimate relationship with her, but individual Christians are not the bride of Christ. Individual Christians are rather sons. You are sons of God in baptism, which as a son makes you, you know, a brother of Christ, a son of the Heavenly Father. It entitles you to an inheritance. It opens up the storehouses of heaven. Everything that belongs to the Son belongs to you in baptism. But so in culture and in the church, women kind of run the day, which I don't want to mislead anyone. This is not, the book is not an attempt to sort of reclaim your rights as a man and sort of, you know, make your case, right? Give back to me what's rightfully mine as a man, which I still would say is antithetical to masculinity, right? Taking is never what it means to be a man. But then you get these, you know, kind of hyper-masculine distortions of what it means to be a man. And so in a reaction against these kind of feminized churches, you get, you know, very masculine kinds of churches, or hyper-masculine kinds of churches, where, you know, one church in Joplin, Missouri was giving away guns on a Father's Day, right? They gave away a couple AR-15s to two, you know, lucky dads. Well, you got to be there on Father's Day to win it. You know, the pastor there, he's kind of known for his brash bravado, you know, beer drinking, hitting on the waitresses is kind of how he's caricatured in the local media, and even made it onto the national scene. But that's not masculinity either, right? Big guns, big trucks, none of that is masculinity. Those things are fine. Tools are fine, right? Guns and trucks and muscles and whatever are just tools. They don't make a man unless he knows how to use the tools, the resources, the things that he has for the good of others. So being a man is never about just asserting your place, taking back what's been taken from you, and trying to, you know, carve out your niche in society. It's always about using yourself as a good for others, right? Sacrifice is what it means to be a man.
So things like guns and other things, they're fine, but that's not what defines masculinity. Guns or sport, or what are some other things that we've we've misconstrued as defining masculinity. Let's use pornography as an example.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, right, sex is a huge thing. And here again, here are the two mentalities, right? The anti-manly mentality is seeing sex as a means for taking. The masculine mentality sees sex as a means for giving. So in those two mindsets, you can easily see where pornography fits, right? Pornography is always taking. It's always invested in the pleasure of myself and not in the good of others, right? And it's intended to be dissatisfying. I have a little bit towards the end of the book on satisfaction and on some of the, like, fascinating research being done on, like, how the chemicals in our brain provide us with a sense of satisfaction. And really, there's this secular book written by Dr. Gregory Burns called, in fact, Satisfaction. And he comes to the conclusion that it's only in the long-term marital sexual union that we really find the kind of satisfaction that we want. Because, you know, there's all can we could really chase this down the rabbit hole, which would be fun, but maybe for a different hour on the radio. It should be no surprise to Christians that this relationship, which God established at the beginning of creation, should be the most fulfilling kind of relationship. And pornography is the opposite of that, right? Pornography provides and masturbation provides a man with, like, pair bonding with just a series of pixels and, you know, pictures on a website where there's no real connection. It's not possible for a man to be giving. It's just taking, and it's just, right, providing pleasure for himself on his own terms. But it's a plague in our culture. And we've kind of come to this idea, well, you know, boys will be boys, and this is just what they'll do. But boys will be boys, but if they will be men, then they've got to quit pornography, masturbation, selfishness, taking, hiding, shame. I mean, all these things are antithetical to good, sacrificial masculinity.
So misuse of this gift of sex and sexuality is really one of the ways that we've misconstrued masculinity.
Right. And we make, you know, sex into a conquest, and the more, you know, the more notches in your belt you have, the more of a man you are in the, you know, the locker room contests with the other men. But that's not at all what masculinity is.
In your book, you use the phrase city of the same. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by this city of the same. You use it in a number of examples as you describe, I think, as you're talking about who we are as a society today.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the kind of feminized society that we live in, where what is praised and what is sought after in children, in adults, wherever, is not the unique expression of genuine, Christians would say, biblical femininity, or genuine, Christians would say, biblical masculinity, but rather this kind of sameness across the board, where, you know, men and women are all the same. And I mean, there was an example of a commune who, again, did not want to give me permission to mention them by name or cite from their website. But they typifies how our culture treats the distinction between sexes, that it's not, you know, biological programming, it's not, you know, the hardware of a person's body, it's not the composition of who a person is that determines, you know, what roles he can do in society. Anything a man can do, a woman should be able to do as well. And so, you take, for instance, the example of allowing women to serve in the front lines of combat, which had lots of people in the military wringing their hands. Like, how are women going to be able to pass these rigorous PT standards that we extract of the men, right? And so the fact that no woman has gone through, like, the SEAL BUDS training yet, the fact that, despite the fact that it's been open to them for some time now, that women are not able to pass those rigorous physical standards, should teach us that there is this inherent difference between men and women. But in the City of the Same, we downplay all that. We hide those differences. And so, right, you know, men and women both equally have to go out and get jobs, have to leave the home, and we denigrate, you know, all the, like, household economy of, you know, rearing children, and, you know, we call them, like, we just make it seem like menial work, right, because it's repetitive, or because we don't give out awards for, like, doing laundry or, you know, making meals when, you know, the clothes are dirty again next week and the meal is eaten by 8 p.m. in the evening and you got to, you know, do it all again the next day. But it used to be that kind of work, that kind of, you know, household economy was sought after and praised and prized. But not anymore. Now, you know, now we outsource the rearing of our children to, you know, babysitters and daycares and preschools. And we outsource the making of our meals to restaurants. And there's no difference between, you know, the men and the women in cubicle America standing around the water cooler, you know, all talking the same, trying to be the same. And that is, you know, that is quintessentially our culture, this City of the Same.
Do we lose something as we move further and further into the City of the Same?
Absolutely. When we don't call men to something higher and holier, we lose what men can bring to the table. And you're seeing this, right, with the laments about fatherless families, which you get across the board. Even secular sociologists conclude children thrive in the household where their biological mother and father are married and raising them together. That statistically provides a child with the best chances for success in his lifetime, period. Now, never let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and there are lots of men and women and children and parents who find themselves in less than ideal situations, but we should never glorify what is less than ideal as being the same as what, you know, basic statistics and mathematics will tell you is better for children. So children don't need two parents. They need a man as a father, and they need a woman as a mother. And even, right, even our bodies tell us that there's something different between men and women, right? Men naturally produce more testosterone, and so they grow bigger muscles. And in the sexual act, men spend, right, in like a single emission in the sexual congress. We have to be careful with our words on radio, right, especially on KFUO. A man has, you know, millions of sperm to a woman's single egg, right? One egg per ovulation per month, and that is a fixed number from the beginning of her lifetime. So a woman then needs to be protected. She has a limited number of eggs. She has a limited time frame in which she produces those, and a monthly cycle, part of which she's fertile and part of which she is not. A man is always producing sperm. And so he is just biologically the more expendable one, and she is not. She is the one to be protected and treasured, and her maternal instincts are to be cultivated. There is, men and women are different in the parenting task, in the marital union, and her body, right? Her body does different things. Not only does it grow life inside of her for 9 months, but then it continues to provide food, nourishment, warmth, safety for a naked, screaming, newborn infant, none of which a man's body can do. But his body, right, stronger most of the time, right, capable of doing what hers cannot, lifting more, whatever. And it does that, and it is that for her good, right, and for the good of his family. And he exists, right, as a shield, as a boundary, a protection for his family.
Let's talk about that relationship between male and female, particularly in the household, the relationship between a husband and wife. What is that relationship between man and woman? What does our contemporary, popular, common world view see it as? And what is true biblical masculinity look like?
Yeah. Well, in the city of the same, a husband is a wife and a wife is a husband. It doesn't really matter. And, I mean, you know, the fact that we can call a same-sex union marriage shows that we don't cherish the distinctiveness of men and women and the biological capacity that only they have for reproducing, right? Two men just don't biologically bear a child. Two women don't biologically bear a child. So whether you believe that there's a creator and a designer behind that, or you believe it's just brute evolutionary force, or some combination of those two, the fundamental fact is only the union of a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, can produce fruit, can bear a child. And so, I mean, that difference kind of sets the stage for everything else in their marriage. And if you want to talk about Christ as the example of masculinity, which Paul does in Ephesians 5, he uses Christ as the example for men, and the church as the example for women. And how many men can cite Ephesians 5:22 by heart, right? Wives, submit to your husbands as the church submits to Christ. And so they say, you submit to me, woman, it's in the Bible. But that's as far as their memory verse goes, right? And they don't get into the part where Paul, in a lot more space and a lot more ink, admonishes men to, I would say, and maybe this is just because, you know, as a man, I have to hear the calling given to men more than the calling given to women, I would say, sounds a whole lot more difficult than just the calling to submit, right? Paul only says, wives, submit and respect your husband. Two things he gives women to do. He gives a wife to do. But
I think it depends on the husband whether or not it's more difficult.
Yeah, well.
My poor wife.
Okay, sure. And the church has no problem submitting to Christ.
Right.
Right? Because she knows that he does all those things that Paul describes in the in-between section, right? Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And so, you know, guys say, oh, yeah, I would do that, right? I'd lay down my life for my wife. No problem. But would you live your life for your wife, right? I think that's more difficult. Not dying for your wife is more difficult than, you know, making that ultimate sacrifice. It's the little ones that are harder to endure. He gave himself up for her that he might, having washed her with water and the word, that he might present her to himself without spot or wrinkle or blemish or any such thing. And this is the part of the book I hate because it indicts the heck out of me. Christ's bride never does anything wrong. She is sinless because he takes her sin away. right? I mean, this would be the end of every marital conflict if every man loved his wife as Christ loved the church, and in his eyes, she never could do anything wrong, right?
Well, yeah, if he lived sacrificially. You mentioned earlier, it's one thing to say you would die for your wife, but to live even more, to live sacrificially for your wife.
Yeah, and to own her sins as your own.
Mm-hmm.
Good night.
I'm sure that was very convicting as you were writing it, because to look at, I mean, you were looking at the ultimate example of masculinity, correct?
Right.
And that is, we're speaking of Jesus.
And we should, yeah. So Christ is the example of masculinity par excellence, but he's also, not even also, more importantly, he doesn't come just to be the way shower or to be the example or to be the icon of what Adam was supposed to be, but he comes to be the one to obtain forgiveness for all of us men who fail regularly as well. And so the first thing men need is not an example. The first thing men need is forgiveness. The first thing men need is new life. And to take us back to that 1 Corinthians 6 that we kind of began with, where Paul condemns effeminacy as a sin that disqualifies you from inheriting the kingdom of heaven, he also says, such were some of you, right? You used to be all these things. You used to be an effeminate, selfish jerk, but you were washed. That's my reading into it, just a little bit. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. You used to be unmanly, effeminate, selfish, but in baptism, God makes you a man. And so elsewhere, he'll talk about the church exists to grow us Christians into mature manhood. And so she does this with the twofold work of Christ, right? To forgive our sins, to put us to death in baptism, to raise us in his resurrection out of the waters of baptism, to crucify our sinful flesh and all of our sinful desires, and then to show us what it means to be a man who loves his bride, a father who, you know, catechizes his children, who brings them up in the fear and the instruction of the Lord, a man who is what Adam was intended to be in creation, self-giving, preserving of others, focused on others, not all the disorder and chaos and sin and selfishness that Adam wrought on the rest of the race of men since then.
We have just under a minute left before we wrap up. Pastor, what final thought do you want us to know before we go out and get this book?
Well, I mean, we could talk about this forever. But if there's if there's one takeaway point, it's this. Masculinity is not about any particular trait, any particular skill, any particular virtue. But masculinity is a habit of using all those things that a man possesses, all of his traits and skills and tools and whatever, strength and wisdom and prowess, using all of that, harnessing everything that he has for the good of others. And this is why, right, the church and society can really get behind this men's movement when it's grounded in biblical masculinity. It's not a disordered kind of selfishness. It's not a retreat to the man cave. It's not, you know, grabbing your tools and storming off to the garage to whatever, right? It is just the exercise of everything a man has for the good of others.
The Reverend Jeff Hemmer, author of Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity, available from Concordia Publishing House, cph.org. Pastor Hemmer, thank you for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at kfuo.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.